Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 5th of December, these are our main stories. The House Judiciary Committee has begun hearing evidence in the Donald Trump impeachment inquiry. The 70th NATO summit has been wrapped up in London on Wednesday. The leaders agreed on numerous issues from China to Poland. And Greenpeace has criticised the Japanese government of covering up radiation hotspots near the starting point of the 2020 Olympic torch relay in Fukushima. Also in this podcast...
Name?
Bond. James Bond.
The trailer for the new James Bond film has been released. We begin the programme with the impeachment inquiry into US President Donald Trump. The Judiciary Committee has taken over after the Intelligence Committee published its report, saying evidence of the president's misconduct was overwhelming. President Trump has denied withholding aid to Ukraine in exchange for information on his political rival, Joe Biden. The committee chair, Jerry Nadler, opened the proceedings on Wednesday with the charge that Mr. Trump had been prepared to compromise national security.
President Trump did not merely seek to benefit from foreign interference in our elections. He directly and explicitly invited foreign interference in our elections. He used the powers of his office to try to make it happen. He sent his agents to make clear that this is what he wanted and demanded. He was willing to compromise our security and his office for personal political gain.
But the Republican ranking member on the panel, Doug Collins, hit back.
You just don't like the guy. You haven't liked him since November of 2016. The chairman has talked about impeachment since last year when he was elected chairman. So don't tell me this is about new evidence and new things and new stuff. We may have a new hearing room, we may have new mics, and we may have chairs that aren't comfortable, but this is nothing new, folks.
Well, the witnesses before the committee have been lawyers with advice for the lawmakers. And that advice has been complex, with legal opinion both for and against impeachment. Republicans called Professor Jonathan Turley, who 21 years ago testified to the same committee during the impeachment process of President Clinton.
I never thought that I would have to appear a second time. The elements are strikingly similar. The intense rancor and rage of the public debate is the same. The stifling intolerance of opposing views. I'm not a supporter of President Trump. I voted against him. My personal views of President Trump are as irrelevant to my impeachment testimony as they should be to your impeachment vote. I'm concerned about lowering impeachment standards to fit a paucity of evidence and an abundance of anger.
Nada Torfik on Capitol Hill told me more about the day's proceedings.
We heard from Jonathan Turley there, but Pamela Carlin from Stanford University actually really hit back at the ranking Republican Doug Collins and his suggestion that there wasn't enough evidence, that the whole process had been flawed. She said that she was insulted by what he said because she had read through every single page of the depositions of public witnesses through these impeachment hearings in the Intelligence Committee. And she said that she is absolutely sure, going through that evidence and with her knowledge of the Constitution, that what the president did struck at the heart of the republic. She says he has threatened to corrupt the electoral process and has undermined the needs of this country in favor of his own personal reelection.
So, Neda, this stage of the proceedings is all about the U.S. Constitution and what it says about impeachment. Is it right to go ahead with impeachment now? Is it possible that there could be a vote in the House before Christmas on that?
Well, that is definitely Democrats' goal at the moment. I think what's really interesting is here we saw, of course, lawmakers turning to legal scholars to see what their interpretation of the Constitution was. But even with those legal arguments, this is first and foremost a political process. And I think Democrats will be satisfied with what they heard in this hearing today to go ahead and try to draft articles of impeachment on not just abuse of power and obstruction, but possibly even bribery. They're going to try to do that soon so that they can move to a full vote of the House of Representatives before Christmas. House. Now, it's important to keep in mind that while that would likely result in President Trump being impeached, but then that would quickly move to a trial in the Senate. There, two-thirds of the Senate is controlled by Republicans, so ultimately his fate and whether he'll be removed from office will lie with his own party.
Not a Torfik. NATO's celebration of its 70th anniversary went ahead on Wednesday with a statement of unity, but underlying tensions remain clearly visible. US President Donald Trump called the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau two-faced after a video emerged showing Mr. Trudeau mocking him. Mr. Trump said he challenged the Canadian Prime Minister about Canada's payments to the Defence Alliance.
Well, he's two-faced. And honestly, with Trudeau, he's a nice guy. I find him to be a very nice guy. But, you know, the truth is that I called him out on the fact that he's not paying 2%. And I guess he's not very happy about it. I mean, you were there, a couple of you were there, and he's not paying 2%, and he should be paying 2%. It's Canada, they have money, and they should be paying 2%. So I called him out on that, and I'm sure he wasn't happy about it, but that's the way it is. Look, I'm representing the U.S., and he should be paying more than he's paying, and he understands it. So I can imagine he's not that happy, but that's the way it is.
As for the main focus of the meeting, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg told a news conference that NATO leaders had agreed to highlight concerns about China's growing influence.
For the first time, we addressed the rise of China, both the challenges and the opportunities it poses, and the implications for our security. Leaders agreed we need to address this together as an alliance, and that we must find ways to encourage China to participate in arms control arrangements.
And another achievement of the meeting was Turkey dropping its opposition to the plan for the defence of the Baltic states and Poland. Well, before the summit, Turkey said that it would block the new plan unless all allies agreed to treat Syrian Kurdish fighters, former allies in the fight against the Islamic State group militants, as terrorists. Jens Stoltenberg said that this showed that NATO is able to move forward and update and revise existing plans.
We have agreed to the updated plan for the Baltic countries and Poland. So I welcome that, and it shows that we are able to also move forward and update and revise plans, including the defence plans for the Baltic countries and Poland.
Paul Henley spoke to our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, who was at the summit.
It was dominated by this drama with the video of a moment at the glittering Buckingham Palace reception where Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, Boris Johnson, Mark Rutte of the Netherlands, Francis Emmanuel Macron were caught gossiping and seeming to mock President Trump. But actually behind the scenes and behind that drama, NATO officials were quietly relieved because that gossiping, if you want to call it that, wasn't really about NATO, its objectives, the alliance. And this was a much calmer meeting than the last one in Brussels, which I also attended, which was full of fire and brimstone, threats from President Trump to leave the alliance, chastising, hammering away at the allies that they had to do more. This time, President Trump read from prepared statements. He talked about being a fan of NATO, much to the relief of Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General. So in terms of the discussion, it wasn't as dramatic as the headlines may seem.
There seems to have been a feeling that President Trump could, so to speak, have gone off on one, and he didn't quite. Is that summing it up?
Yes, in the sense of I think everyone has begun to hold their breath a bit when President Trump is involved, especially if in this case you're take Canada, 75% of its trade is with the United States. They have to be very careful with how they deal with President Trump, even though this time they were on slippery ground. But this time, President Trump didn't launch any diplomatic or political bombshells. Yes, he did describe President Macron's statement on NATO, describing it as strategically brain dead, as being very, very nasty. But by the end of the day, he was hitching a ride with the U.S. president in that famous beast of a limousine to go from Buckingham Palace to 10 Downing Street. So I think it is what Justin Trudeau said in his remarks about what had happened with President Trump. President Trump is notoriously sensitive. He didn't like that they were, in effect, poking fun at his extraordinary long news conferences. The first one, for example, on yesterday morning was supposed to last 3 minutes and lasted 53 minutes. And in peak, he cancelled his last press conference of the day. But other than that, it all seemed to have really gone away today. And the NATO officials we spoke to as we left the gathering said they felt that it had gone actually rather well. It doesn't mean there aren't differences, but the core of the alliance, they felt, still remains strong.
And then this apparent breakthrough with Turkey. Do you know exactly what other NATO members said to reassure Turkey and cause this climb down?
Well, there you go. Now, in our conversation we're having, we mentioned the three big beasts of NATO, President Trump, President Macron, and President Erdogan, all of whom had approached this 70th birthday gathering with some real strong words about NATO. President Erdogan had threatened to block what is a really crucial mission of NATO, defending the Baltic states and Poland, if NATO members did not recognize Turkey's enemies, as it sees it, the Syrian Kurds, as its enemy. In the end, Turkey pulled away from that, said it won't block it, and agreed to accept what was a general condemnation of all forms of terrorism. Whether Turkey will seek other forms of compensation, we'll see. There was also a discussion, President Macron said, about Turkey keeping its NATO partners better informed so there isn't a repeat of what happened in October when the US president and the Turkish president basically arranged after a phone call for American troops to pull out and Turkish troops to push in to northern Syria, where there were also British and French forces fighting alongside the Americans against so-called Islamic State. So there were some quiet discussions about how to work better on issues that affect them all. That's not to say there isn't going to be more drama, more mistakes, more altercations in public. But I think that's the way the alliances of this kind work in the kind of time we live in now.
Lise Doucette. Air pollution is a problem in cities across the developing world. But now a new piece of technology has been developed that could help communities find ways of reducing the problem. Solomon Sawanja reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
That smoke will wake you up. You won't be able to sleep.
Tina Muwenes lives in Nairobi's Mukuru shantytown. It's an industrial area and home to hundreds of thousands of people. Many live in corrugated iron shacks, often near to factories.
When you breathe those particles, it's so painful.
Tina and her one-year-old daughter live near a steel mill.
I had to take her to the hospital, and you cannot go to the hospital free without any coin. You have to take her alone.
Much of the city suffers from a toxic mix of emissions from traffic, industries, and the burning of rubbish. A test shows Borita Muweni's lung capacity is only half what it should be. Here in Mukuru, the number of cases of pneumonia, chest infection, and asthma have doubled in the last 12 months. I'm with about 10 patients who have come to attend an asthma clinic. It's the very young who are suffering the most.
There's nearly 750,000 people living in this community, and many of them are struggling to breathe because of the air quality. Now, there's a team of African scientists who have come up with ways of measuring the air quality here, and they think that this is a step forward in finding a solution to this problem.
A technician attaches one of these air pollution sensors to a wooden post. It is a white plastic box. It costs around $50. It records the amount of dangerous small particles in the air. That data is then transmitted to a website where it can be accessed for free by anyone. Yasmin Jamali works for Code for Africa, the organization that supplies the sensors.
Our sensors are very easy to assemble, and our data is accurate, which means anyone in any city across any African country will be able to use it, deploy it, and get real-time local data that they can use to petition governments to solve problems that they face around air pollution.
So this is that sensor that you installed.
John Kietzi organized the installation of sensors in his neighborhood after concerns about a local factory.
We used the data that was coming from those sensors to launch a social media campaign. Our campaign got the attention of the media and the government agencies that were ignoring us before. And the government agencies came over and instructed the factory to shut down and only open after they had complied with their laws.
Rashida and Nazia Hakada live near another steel mill in Nairobi. They show me photos of their two-year-old daughter, Hafsa, who died in April. She was suffering from acute respiratory distress syndrome. That is when the lungs cannot provide the body's organs with enough oxygen. Doctors told them that the pollution was a possible cause of their daughter's death. Rashida is afraid for the future of their surviving children, especially their young son.
This is too much for him. He's only 6 years old. He's coughing. When he coughs for a whole full week. He has to get antibiotics. How long am I going to go on? And he's such a small boy. He's so weak. He's not. I'm worried I might even lose him one day because of a factory.
Nazia says the data from the local sensors will show there is a pollution problem.
Data will not lie. Sensors will not lie. It's very clear. All you need to do is use that, and you'll get the answers you need.
Code for Africa is planning to install 3,000 more sensors across the continent. They hope this will help citizens in the fight for clean air for their families and communities.
Solomon Sawanja reporting. Scientists have, for the first time, found evidence that planets can continue orbiting a dying star. Astronomers made the discovery whilst observing a star system around about 2,000 light years away from Earth. Their findings could offer new insights into how the sun's demise, billions of years in the future, will affect our own planet. Our science and technology correspondent, Paul Rinken, has been finding out more.
The solar system as we know it won't be around forever. In about 6 billion years, the sun will have puffed up to many times its current size. As it expands, it will destroy the Earth before collapsing into a small core called a white dwarf. Astronomers have been observing a distant star system where this has already happened. They were able to detect a giant planet about 4 times the size of Earth, which probably survived the cataclysm because it was far away from the expanding star. Dr. Christopher Mansour is from the team at the University of Warwick, which made the discovery.
The white dwarf that we're looking at is about 30,000 degrees Celsius. The sun is 6,000, so it's almost 5 times as hot. It's going to be producing a lot more UV radiation than the sun. And then not even just the radiation, the gravitational forces are very large. If a body gets too close to a white dwarf, like an asteroid, the gravity is so strong that the asteroid will be ripped apart.
The giant planet still has a thick atmosphere, but this is gradually being stripped away by radiation from the dead star. Scientists want to further study the white dwarf and its planet to learn exactly how our solar system could evolve billions of years in the future.
Paul Rinkel. Coming up later in the podcast,
a bike with an enormous box on the back of it. And by box, I mean something sort of the size of a refrigerator, give or take.
Can cargo bikes replace delivery trucks and vans? Months on from the murder of a man in a Berlin park, Germany is throwing 2 Russian diplomats out of the country. The victim was a former Chechen rebel commander, and German officials believe the shooting was ordered by Russia or Russia's Chechen Republic. Moscow has denied the allegations and says that it's going to retaliate. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, was asked about the case at the latest NATO summit in London.
I'm meeting the Russian president next week and I will inform him of the measures we took. We took this decision because we did not see that Russia was supporting us in clearing up this murder.
Germany's Interior Minister Horst Seehofer indicated at a news conference that the case was about to be escalated.
As a result of a sequence of events, it was, thank God, possible to detain the suspect, and we can only be grateful to those who alerted the police. And following this, in Germany, there is a criminal process that deals with this sort of thing. And in the case of a crime with this kind of significance and with this background, I can only thank the Attorney General that they have taken it on. This in itself says something about the significance of this crime, including the political background. The government is still in discussion as to what possible further consequences there could be.
Our Berlin correspondent Damien McGuinness told me more about the victim.
Well, he was killed last August. He was going for a walk in a small park in the centre of Berlin on his way to a mosque, apparently. His name is Zelimkhan Kangashvili. He is an ethnic Chechen from the Pangisi Gorge in Georgia. So he's a Georgian citizen. Now, it seems that he was shot twice in the head by a man passing by on a bicycle. Witnesses say that the cyclist then rode off. German police later then found this suspected killer as he was getting rid of the bike, disposing of the bike and the weapon, the gun, in a nearby river. Now, this suspect has been held by German police since August. He refused to speak, but it seems he is a Russian citizen. Now, what the allegations are of the German state prosecutor is that the Georgian citizen, Mr. Kangashvili, was killed under orders from Russia. Now, whether this means the Kremlin or some other authority in Russia, it's not clear. But that's because he was a fighter against Russia in the Chechen War. So as such, he was an enemy of the Russian state. That's the allegation so far.
So several months on, these two diplomats are being kicked out of Germany. It seems like quite an understated response from Berlin, given what, for example, happened after the Sergei Skripal poisoning in Britain, where numerous diplomats were expelled from various different countries.
Yeah, I mean, this is being called the second Skripal case, but actually there are a few differences. One is that this was not a German citizen, he was a Georgian citizen. The other difference is that we don't yet have that much evidence as to who was behind this and what the allegations are about. So far, the German authorities, and indeed the German government, as we heard Angela Merkel just there say the reason for the expulsion of the diplomats, the two employees at the Russian embassy in Berlin, is because the Russian authorities are not helping with the investigation. So far, no German official is, or no German government official is openly accusing the Russian state of involvement in this killing. German state prosecutors say there may be Russian state involvement, but that's as far as it goes so far. So people are being very circumspect because obviously this is a big thing and this could turn into a huge diplomatic row. As it is, though, the fact that two employees of the Russian embassy are being expelled is pretty big. And Russia has said they're not happy. They view this as a very unfriendly act, is how Russia has responded to this, and has denied any involvement in the killing and said that they will retaliate.
Let's head to South America now, where almost 5 million Venezuelans have left their homeland over the past 4 years to search for a better life abroad. Colombia is home to the largest number of Venezuelan immigrants, but now Peru is not far behind. The BBC's reporter there, Stefania Gosse, has been finding out why so many Venezuelans have chosen to make it their home.
Mi nombre es Luis Rangel. Soy de Venezuela. Llegué ayer a Lima.
My name is Luis Rangel. I'm from Venezuela. I arrived in Lima last night after a 10-day journey. I'm cold, tired, and my feet are swollen. I walked all the way here. I wouldn't wish that upon anyone.
This is the harrowing story of Luis Rangel, a Venezuelan migrant. I met Luis at a migrant shelter set up by a local businessman in Lima, Peru's capital. He traveled over 2,000 kilometers to get to this two-story house packed with 200 Venezuelans. Hola. The house has a big courtyard in the entrance. This is a socializing and dining area during the day, but in the evenings, dozens of mattresses are laid on the floor. The mattresses are lined up on a side right now, and there is a barber corner where a woman was having her eyebrows shaved this morning by a young man. So why are they here?
Welcome back to GMT, I'm Geeta Gurumuthi.
After months of food shortages, spiralling inflation and political turmoil, Venezuelans can take no more. Hundreds of thousands of people have fled the country, many on foot, carrying only suitcases.
Venezuela's long-running economic crisis and political instability have led to one of the world's largest mass migrations of people. Remar Perdomo is a Venezuelan migrant who became famous last year singing in the streets of Lima. In this song, she tells the story of why she left her country. Since 2015, more than 4 million Venezuelans have made the same decision.
Venezolanos, bienvenidos al Perú.
Just over a year ago, Peru's then-president Pedro Pablo Kuczynski made an open invitation to Venezuelans to come and work in the country. He made it easy for them to get work visas. But a few months later, the policy was dropped with a new government. I asked former economy minister Alonso Segura what the effect of all of this had been.
It's regrettable that Peru has to request visas, but some measures had to be taken. There's about 800,000 migrants so far. If you want to put that in context, there's about 300,000 entrants to the labor market each year, and these 800,000 have been mostly over the past 18 months.
Peru has given a lot of work permits to Venezuelans. Is it realistic to think that all these Venezuelans will join the formal economy?
There's a large portion that, despite having a work permit, they will not be able to get a formal job.
The welcome that Venezuelans have received varies throughout Peru. I've come 400 kilometers north of the capital to a small city called Huaraz. Here, tensions are much higher. This funeral procession in the main square quickly turned into an anti-Venezuelan demonstration. This woman told me she blamed Venezuelan immigrants for her auntie's death. Apparently, she'd been shot after leaving a bank. Alfredo Torres heads up the Peruvian branch of Ipsos, a global organization that carries out opinion polls.
The reason of these negative opinions in general are because of crime. The other reason is economic, because most of them are willing to work for lower salaries. And certainly there are Peruvians that are losing their jobs because of this situation.
What Alfredo says seems to be the case of this group of Venezuelan men I found on the road.
Our goal was to reach Ecuador, but when we heard that the border with Peru was going to close, we headed here, because there are more opportunities here.
Right now, we are waiting for a man who has offered us a job in construction.
How much did he offer?
40 soles.
That'd be $13 a day. What do you think about that?
For us, $13 is a blessing, because we haven't eaten.
That report by Stefania Gosse from the Peruvian capital, Lima. Greenpeace says it's found radiation hotspots near the starting point of the 2020 Olympic torch relay in Fukushima, Japan. The levels recorded at the J Village sports complex, about 20 kilometres from the nuclear reactor that was damaged by the 2011 tsunami, were 1,775 times normal levels. Attempts to talk down any dangers in Fukushima before the Olympics have led to criticism of the government in Japan. Paul Henley spoke to Greenpeace's senior nuclear specialist, Sean Burney.
The J Village was built as a sports complex, actually funded by Tokyo Electric, the owner of the Fukushima Daiichi plant in 1997. At the time of the meltdown of the three reactors in 2011, it was then used over the following 7 years as a sort of center for the many thousands of workers who were struggling with the plant. And only beginning of this year was it handed back to the authorities, to Fukushima Prefecture, and has been used as a sports center. We visited Fukushima in October as part of our annual radiation survey, and that included spending a few hours at the J Village, which is about 20 kilometers south of the nuclear plant. Within a matter of minutes of getting out in the car park, our radiation advisors were finding high levels, what we call hotspots. These are concentrated areas The general background actually at J-Village is relatively low, although higher than in 2011. But these hotspots were really quite shocking to us. And that was the point we decided we had to inform the Japanese government and the various Olympic committees. And we did so on the 18th of November. We gave them 1 month basically to respond and to basically put in place a decontamination program.
And what happened?
Well, we were waiting to hear back from the Japanese government. We had been in contact both with J-Village and the government and were not getting anywhere. And then yesterday we were contacted by a journalist from one of the Japanese newspapers who clearly had been provided the details of the long letter that we sent to the Japanese government and the Olympic committees, including the IOC in Lausanne. It was at that point we realized they were going to go public, which they did this morning, and we were then forced to explain what the situation was. Our original aim was, this is a public health issue, first priority. It's not about campaigning. It's not about making media headlines. And we were giving the Japanese government and the authorities the opportunity to basically put in place a serious decontamination program in advance of the torch route beginning in March.
Now, you mentioned these hotspots. Just to be clear, how hazardous, if at all, are these levels to humans?
Well, obviously, when we talk about hotspots, it's obviously a very specific location, this point at ground level. No one is going to spend a whole year at that spot. If they were, they would be getting a serious radiation dose. The problem is that, well, twofold. If you had that level of contamination inside a nuclear facility, the authorities, the owners of the facility, would have to basically declare that an incident and would decontaminate immediately. It would be a controlled area. People would not be able to access it. This is a car park at a center when we were there one Saturday on the 26th of October, where there were many, many soccer teams. There were many hundreds of spectators. There were spectators and fans and players sitting meters away, enjoying their lunch, and they were completely, of course, unaware that this hazard existed. The more serious issue is actually, what are these particles that are concentrating this radioactivity? Over the last 3 years or so, there's been enough evidence coming out that at the time of the accident in March 2011, the type of accident that it was released very concentrated and many, many millions, potentially billions of these so-called cesium-rich microparticles. These are very small particles that potentially could be inhaled. And they're concentrating in the environment. They're not soluble. And they are of a size that are respirable. And at that point, you have a much more serious hazard than the general radiation.
Now, Japan has suffered massively in the wake of this nuclear accident. Do you want the event cancelled? More bad news for the country?
No, the Greenpeace position is very clear. We don't formally have a position on the Olympics. What we want is the Japanese government to stop deceiving and saying that everything is returning to normal in Fukushima, and basically where there's areas of contamination, deal with it.
That was Greenpeace's senior nuclear specialist, Sean Burney, talking to Paul Henley. With the rise in popularity of online shopping, delivery trucks and vans carrying the resulting packages tend to fill city streets all over the world. In New York, they're adding to traffic jams and increasing pollution. But city officials have a plan to replace many of the trucks and vans with cargo bikes. Paul Henley asked New York's Transportation Commissioner, Polly Trottenberg, about them.
It looks like basically a bike with an enormous box on the back of it. And by box, I mean something sort of the size of a refrigerator, give or take.
Sounds a real pain to maneuver around the streets of New York.
The good news is, one, the bikes are what we call pedal assisted. So they have a battery which helps you pedal them. I just rode a couple of them. They're actually pretty maneuverable. And the companies that are going to be doing this pilot of cargo bikes are going to use them to replace trucks. They are a lot easier to maneuver on the streets of New York than trucks.
And they're a lot greener.
They are a lot greener and we hope a lot safer and will have a lot less impact on traffic and congestion on our streets.
How do pedestrians and drivers react to them? What are the problems?
Well, we're about to find out in this pilot, but, you know, I think we've announced it today. And I have to say, I think we got just a very good reaction outside on the street talking to people. Certainly in New York right now, where we are seeing New Yorkers getting 1.5 million packages delivered a day, the increase in truck traffic, the congestion is bringing, the air quality issues, and unfortunately safety issues. We've had, unfortunately this year, a large number of cyclists killed in incidents involving trucks. So there's a real desire in New York to see what can be done to reduce the number of trucks on our streets.
Now, most people will imagine the traffic in New York City to be pretty heavy, stop, start, stuff, particularly at this time of year. How much worse are delivery vans actually making it?
They are a big part of the issue here in New York. We have about 100,000 trucks that come into the city every day. And look, New York is not different than London or any other city around the world. We're seeing just an ever-growing amount of what we call e-commerce. You know, Amazon and all these other companies delivering packages. The younger generation here in New York, many of them get several packages a week.
And these companies are well aware of the problems they are causing. Are they? They're in on the solution.
Absolutely. And today we stood with three of the big industry players, DHL, UPS, and Amazon. And all three companies talked about the desire to do more to try and be environmentally friendly, to reduce emissions, to use electric vehicles. From their point of view, they're hoping it's going to make their operations easier and more efficient because these bikes are more maneuverable. They are easier to pull up to the curb and do those pick up and drop offs as packages as well.
And how much of a free pass will cargo bikes get? Can they park on the pavement? Do they have to put money in a meter?
For the purposes of this pilot, we're going to let them pull into what we call our commercial loading zones here in New York City, where typically trucks would pull in to do, you know, whatever business or pick up and drop offs they would need. We're going to let cargo bikes do that and not pay at the meter. We're encouraging them to be expeditious, get in, deliver their packages, and keep moving. We don't want them sitting at the spaces all day. And we're hoping that's going to make really efficient use of these spaces. We'll see in the long run whether that's the right financial model, but that's what we're going to try out here, this first iteration of the pilot.
They look quite like tuk-tuks, some of these bikes. I think other cities around the world have perhaps had the idea first.
Well, I think you're right, actually. I mean, yeah, in some ways we're hearkening back to an era where goods were delivered by cart, and in certain parts of the world they still do that. You know, here in New York, we're kind of back to the future on that. Again, you know, with a modern sensibility of particularly being concerned, again, about air quality and carbon emissions, roadway safety, and the growing congestion that we see in our city. We do see these as part of the solution to those challenges.
I hope your driver cyclists are wrapping up warm.
I thought today it's nippy here in New York. They are bundled up for sure. And just, I would also say, you know, one nice thing about working with these industry partners, the drivers are well trained. They will be working with New York City DOT to make sure they get our commercial cyclist safety training. So we're hoping they will be bundled up warm and be a safe and really professional presence on the street.
That was New York's Transportation Commissioner, Polly Trottenberg, speaking to Paul Henley. And finally, after a break of more than 4 years, 007 is back. The trailer for the new James Bond film, No Time to Die, is out and already racking up millions of views across the world. This will be the last time Daniel Craig, who is the sixth actor to play the role of James Bond, will be starring in the film series as the secret agent. Let's hear a bit of it right now.
The world's moved on, Commander Bond.
You were 00?
2 years. So stay in your lane. You get in my way, I will put a bullet in your knee.
All exciting stuff, as you can imagine. I've been speaking to Charlotte Gallagher for more about the upcoming film.
This is the first Bond film since the Me Too movement swept through Hollywood, Nick. So we knew there'd be changes. But the thing is, Bond films have been evolving, especially since Daniel Craig took over the role, because things that were in the classic films of the 60s and 70s, you just wouldn't be able to get away with now. They're just not accepted, particularly the role of women and how women are treated. So in some of the classic films, women, essentially their role was to look pretty, fall at James Bond's feet, and then often get killed off within minutes of appearing on the screen by a villain. So in this film, as you said, we're getting a female 00 agent played by Lashana Lynch. And women now have to be fleshed out characters, not just plot devices for James Bond. And also, one thing we are continuing with in this film is having these big Oscar winners playing the baddies. So we've had Christopher Waltz, Javier Bardem. Now in this film, it's Rami Malek, who people may remember winning an Oscar for Bohemian Rhapsody. He's playing the villain. He's in the trailer. You sort of see him in this Phantom of the Opera style mask. And the speculation is that he is actually Dr. No. So if people have watched the old James Bond films, the classic villain, Dr. No, he is the reincarnation of that character. But we're going to have to wait and see.
So lots of nods to the past there. But the filming itself hasn't been without its difficulties, has it?
Oh, totally. So Daniel Craig seemed a bit reluctant to even sign on for this last film. He was quoted in one magazine as saying he'd rather slash his wrists than play James Bond again. He was injured during the filming. They switched directors because the director pulled out because of creative differences. The next question is, who's going to be the next James Bond?
Charlotte Gallagher there. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.